on Human Services. On May 18th, 2009, I will open up the public hearing and the work session. Possible work session on House Bill 123.
Senate Bill 123.
Senate Bill 123.
Have another sip, Carol.
Have another drink of coffee. Senate Bill 123 requires the Department of Human Services to make records compiled under child abuse reporting statutes available to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission for investigations of complaints pertaining to licensing violations for incidents involving any child or student grade 12 or below. It requires that the records released by DHS to the commission be kept confidential and declares an emergency.
Thank you. And we have only one person signed up. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Oregon Teacher Standards Practices Commission. My first time in front of you this session, but I see half of the House Ed Committee is in here. So, this bill came out of some interim work that we did after a series of articles in the Oregonian last February about educator misconduct. And in the course of the time that I've been in the commission in the last 7 years, we've had difficulty getting reports out of DHS related to educators because I think they had trouble finding a sound legal basis to protect when they should and shouldn't release the records. And we weren't specifically on the list of folks to whom should receive the records. So we have worked very closely with DHS on this bill. They're back here behind us to support us. And so far the partnership's going swimmingly. We've had the opportunity to test it on a request in the last few weeks, and we're able to work closely with Stacy Ayers to get the report. But sometimes these can be crucial reports. They can work in favor of an educator, or they can possibly work as evidence against an educator, but they're particularly valuable when there hasn't been a criminal conviction. We probably have a need for these reports about two or three times a year.
Thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. Any questions of this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Colleagues, are you ready to vote on this, or do you want to hold it over for another couple days?
Ready.
Let's vote.
Ready.
Let's
do it.
Yep. Right. And, Madam Chair, do we have any record of the Senate vote? Was it?
I don't have that in my stuff. We can look it up pretty quickly.
Computers could tell us real quick what the vote was.
Committee was unanimous.
I'll tell you here.
I figured you probably could.
Committee was unanimous.
And the floor was 29-4, one excused.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to know?
Thank you.
Anything else before we move on? Okay, Representative Olson.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the Senate Bill 123A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 123A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Keith, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Denbrough.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative
Van Orman? Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Absent.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye.
Madam Chair, I forgot to mention to you that he asked to be excused for about the first 15 minutes because he's testifying in another committee.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So how do I change that?
I think just telling him will be sufficient.
Okay. Thank you. All right, thank you, Representative. With that having received the required majority, Senate Bill 123A passes. We'll go on to the floor. Anybody like to volunteer to carry this?
Representative Van Orman raised her hand.
Great, terrific. Thank you, Representative. That will close the hearing and work session on Senate Bill 123A, and we'll move on to Senate Bill 166A for a public hearing and possible work session.
This bill authorized the Department of Corrections to lease to the Department of Human Services all or part of the real property known as the Milron Road site. It permits DHS to build, own, and operate on the property a hospital to provide diagnosis and evaluation, medical care, detox, social services, rehabilitation, and other services to individuals committed to DHS or the state hospital. It authorizes the departments to enter into an agreement transferring hospital ownership from DHS to DOC and declares an emergency.
Thank you. Okay, so we have Doug, is that correct? Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Chair Tomey and members of the Human Services Committee. I am Doug Young, new prison construction administrator for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 166A. What Senate Bill 166A does is it clarifies statutorily the authority for the department to first lease land to the Department of Human Services, secondly allows DHS to build on our Mill Iron Road site, and thirdly to allow DHS in the future to transfer the ownership of those buildings back to the DOC should the governor, with the governor's approval. In conversations with the Department of Justice, it was advised that the statutes be amended to give DOC the explicit authority to lease the Junction City site to DHS so that there would be no delays in building of their state hospital.
Any questions of this witness? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? Okay. Colleagues, this is another one. Looks pretty simple. Do you want to vote on this today, or would you like to wait and think about it or ask anybody else about it? You ready to vote?
Yeah, I think we can vote.
Okay.
Sure. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 166A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 166A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, Keith, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Excused.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomek?
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 166 passes. And, colleagues, it looks to me like this might be one we could put on the consent agenda. Everybody agree to that?
So.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it will go. Close the hearing and work session on Senate Bill 166A and move on to Senate Bill 177A. We'll open up a work session and a public hearing on 177A.
Senate Bill 177A changes the State Board of Clinical Social Workers to the State Board of Licensed Social Workers. It creates additional Title Act protections for non-clinical social workers by adding voluntary licenses for those not practicing clinical social work. It designates standards for certified and licensed clinical social workers and prohibits the use of titles for individuals who are not qualified as under the statute. It adds a practice act for clinical social workers and delays implementation to January 2011.
Thank you, Keely. I think we have four people. I assume you would like to be as a panel. Is that correct? Becky Rasmussen, Martin Cidioni, Jessica Ritter, and Stacy Orr. And you can just bring up another chair if you will.
If I can just say, you do have dash 7 and 8 amendments in your packets. Received those last week, and those are recommended by the advocates.
Thank you. And I know you've been working hard on this, both on the Senate side and on the House side, and we appreciate that. And I think you have a product that you'd like to move forward. So who's ever ready?
Chair.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Becky Rasmussen, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker with a private practice in Salem. I currently serve as vice chair of the Board of Clinical Social Workers, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to request your strong support for the board's Senate Bill 177-A. With me today is the board's executive director, Martin Pidioni, who will assist me with any questions you may have about the bill. Mr. Pidioni is the person most directly involved with stakeholder negotiations. This board is very pleased to bring you this consensus bill, product of much hard work with many stakeholders, especially the Governor's Office, Department of Human Services, and the Department of Corrections. The bill is supported by the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter, and the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. It is easiest to explain what the bill does and why the bill is so important, not just to the board and its supporters, but to the constituents of every legislator in this building, by placing the bill in the context of the board's current authority or lack thereof. Under current law, the board is strictly limited in its jurisdiction to only those persons who choose to become a licensed or certified social worker because they want to use the titles Clinical Social Work Associate or Licensed Clinical Social Worker. The technical shorthand term for this is title protection. What this means is that only those who are licensed or certified with the board under these two licenses are allowed to refer to themselves and advertise themselves to the public and other parties such as employers or insurance companies as LCSWs or CSWAs. These licensees and certificate holders are under the full authority of the board for their conduct and must meet rigorous licensure requirements, including for an LCSW 2 years of supervised clinical practice and a national examination after the completion of a master's in social work. The board's total current licensee base is about 3,500, including inactive licensees. Our licensees can be found in a variety of settings such as hospitals, schools, medical clinics, mental health clinics, and in private practice, as well as in community settings, both urban and rural areas. Unlicensed individuals can practice as well, but are not allowed to hold themselves out as licensed by the board or use one of the two protected titles. Oregon is only one of seven states in the nation that does not protect against the unlicensed practice of clinical social work. This means that in Oregon, anyone who wants to practice any form of social work at any level, including clinical social work involving assessment, diagnosis, and therapy services, can, without any regulation, licensure, or being subject to penalties from the board, can practice. It is nothing short of embarrassing and shameful that under current board authority, the maximum consequence for having sex with a client, which is revocation of a license, only means that the former licensee can no longer call himself an LCSW, but keep right on practicing, including to continue with such harmful behavior with zero authority by the board to do something about it. I wish I could tell you this is just theoretical, but the bottom line is the board has revoked licensees for sexual transgressions, and we know for a fact this has not stopped their ability to practice. One of our cases, the case of Leo Munter, revoked for sexual misconduct in 2000, received special attention in a May 23, 2007 Oregonian article after a client attempted to file a complaint and discovered Mr. Munter was continuing to practice unlicensed after his license had been revoked. Obviously, in Oregon, we are out of step with the rest of the country and with much of the remaining health professions here by not requiring a license for anyone who practices clinical social work. The board's perspective is that Oregonians who utilize the services of a social work professional in times of crisis or distress need to be able to trust that the person providing assistance has the basic education, competence, and expertise to meet their needs and will treat and support them in an ethical manner. This is where Senate Bill 177A before you comes in. The board received strong support from the legislators in the Senate Committee on Human Services on Rural Health Policy to move beyond the original bill as printed and include Practice Act language. Similar support was expressed by legislators on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education that heard our budget. So what Senate Bill 177A before you represents is a very, very carefully crafted consensus bill after earlier attempts to put together and pass a full practice act. Mandating licensure for the whole social work profession did not achieve consensus to move forward. In brief, the bill before you today mandates licensure for those practicing clinical social work only, in effective January 1, 2011, expands sanction authority by the Board of Clinical Social Workers by allowing the Board to maintain jurisdiction over revoked licensees, increase a civil penalty to a maximum of $3,000 per violation, with a $5,000 for Title Act unlicensed practice violations, permits voluntary registration for non-clinical bachelor-level social workers, permits voluntary licensure for non-clinical master-level social workers, authorizes application fees and licensure registration renewals for the RBSWs, which is the bachelor social work, and the licensed master-level social workers, and changes the name of the board to Board of Licensed Social Workers. In essence, the bill expands the authority to non-clinical areas of social work for the first time, but does so on a very limited voluntary basis. That portion of the bill retains a Title Act approach. Most significantly, the bill finally, in its amended form, contains a Consensus Practice Act provision limited to the practice of clinical social work only. On that latter piece is where the board's amendments come in. The additional -7 amendments that the board respectfully requests for this committee to move into the bill are born out of the circumstance that the board's negotiations with stakeholders did not include the Clinical Social Work Practice Act piece until the A engrossed version. The -A7 amendments are submitted to you in the interest of maintaining a consensus bill. Basically, given the broader reach of the A engrossed bill, we and some of our stakeholders did not initially recognize some of the potential unintended consequences of the broader Practice Act language until the bill was already out of the Senate. The board's basic policy approach, in interest of public protection, is to exempt from the clinical social work licensure requirement only those with an alternative appropriate form of licensure. The -A version of the bill thus exempts those with other licenses or certifications from the state of Oregon to provide mental health services and includes a standard exemption for recognized members of the clergy when acting in their official ministerial capacity and an exemption for enrolled graduate social work students providing clinical services as part of their supervised practicum. The -A7s address the additional areas of concern that were recognized after the bill passed out of the Senate. The first -A7s specifically exempt certified alcohol and drug counselors. It is our understanding there are over 2,500 such certified individuals in the state, with most certified by the Addiction and Counselor Certification Board of Oregon. This bill was not intended to undermine or replace that certification construct. The -A7 amendments before you add the CADCs to the exemption list, with the normal limitation that this exemption goes as far as the lawful scope of that certification. The language does not expand or narrow the scope of what a CADC is currently entitled to do, nor does it give the right to a CADC to hold themselves out as licensed, certified, or registered by this board.
Becky, I'm going to ask you to stop just for a minute. Okay. Could everybody please take out their cell phones and their Blackberries and their Blueberries? Take them out and put them in your hand, please. Anybody has one?
Do you want me to go back?
Yeah, please. And now, could you make sure it's turned absolutely off, not mute, because something is interfering with the sound, and I want to make sure we hear all of Becky's testimony. So when I'm talking to members of the committee also.
I just did.
Okay.
I never bring mine.
Bring mine.
Yeah. Mine is dysfunctional.
I'm a good boy.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. I didn't want to lose any of your testimony, okay. Becky, because I think it's really important and it interferes with this.
So
recording.
You weren't thinking of having us do push-ups or something like
I might.
I don't know my phone is on.
Thank you. Okay. Sorry to have interrupted you, Becky.
Okay, similarly, Similarly, the Dash Sevens also exempt qualified mental health professionals and qualified mental health associates. This is captured in Section 3 of the Dash A7 amendments referencing DHS statutes. You may notice that this section is written a bit differently than the other exemption sections. One reason for this is that the QMHA and QMHP status is a program-based certification, not an individual license or certification. The program certification is undertaken by the Department of Human Services Addiction and Mental Health Division, certifying community mental health programs. Those individuals delivering mental health services within that program certification meet qualifications outlined in DHS Chapter 308, Division 16. The bottom line here is that Senate Bill 177A was intended to exempt that construct, the mental health program services delivery and eligibility of those services for federal Medicaid funds. This was fully in line with the intent of this bill not to require licensure or certification where there are alternative standards and accountability in place for services delivered within that construct. We realized that after Senate Bill 177A had passed the Senate and that the language in Senate Bill 177A that we thought would accomplish these exemptions, in fact, did not do that. And that is why we need these pieces as well and respectfully ask this committee to include them. I also need to add for the record that we appreciate greatly the efforts of DHS and the Association of Community Mental Health Programs to bring you the consensus language for this amendment. There is an additional compromise here that this exemption does not have the standard language used in other exemptions that specifically prohibits a QMHA and QMHP from representing him or herself as a social worker regulated by this board. The board agreed to this in order to get a consensus and with the clear understanding also conveyed to stakeholders that Section 3 of the bill already gives the board full authority to sanction prohibited use of one of the protected titles. The Dash A7s also make a technical correction in our statutes to make clear that the board statutes do not prevent a licensee, certificate holder, or registrant from releasing records to the board in connection with a board request or investigation. I want to close briefly with a word about the Dash A8 amendments brought to you by the National Association of Social Workers, or NASW. NASW will present to you the policy case for these amendments, which would add the term social worker to the protected titles enforced by the board effective January 1st, 2011. In essence, the amendments propose that from that point on, only those licensed by this board at any level could refer to themselves as social workers. While the board has a neutral position on these amendments, I want to state for the record that NASW has been very gracious in working with the board to edit the language of the amendments to ensure that they would be workable for the board if adopted by this committee. There was an inadvertent delay on the Senate side in having these amendments ready in a final version, and NASW was again gracious to the board in not delaying Senate consideration of the bill over that issue and agreed to hold off on their proposed amendments until the bill reached the House. Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for hearing this important bill and for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. Martin Pidioni and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Becky. Would you like us to have everybody on the boards or in this panel speak and then allow questions, or would you like us to ask questions right away? Which would be your preference?
You can do it all. You can have the whole panel go.
Yeah. Go ahead and do the panel.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Ritter. I'm a member of the National Association of Social Workers, and I'm also a professor of social work here in Oregon. First, I want to say that I'm here to fully support this bill, Senate Bill 177-A, and I want to thank the State Board of Clinical Social Workers for all of their hard work and countless hours that they have put into this bill. They worked with us very collaboratively, and as a result, I think this is a very strong piece of legislation. As a social work educator, I just wanted to emphasize how important it is that most social workers, if not all, are regulated by the state. I think it's very important that consumers who work with social workers, you know, as you know, we work with a lot of people who are very vulnerable, children, older adults, people with developmental disabilities. So I think it's very important that they are protected and that there's a process in place if they are found to work with a social worker who is unethical or violates their rights. I also would like to talk about the title protection piece of this bill, the amendment that NASW offered. We really believe that title protection is a very important piece of this legislation. And I think that when people meet someone who's calling themselves a social worker, they should know that that person has had the training, the education, they have a degree in social work, and also that they are regulated by the state. So we feel very strongly that the title protection piece is a very important part of this piece of legislation. Many of my students often find it surprising and upsetting when they have completed their required training and their coursework, and they're required to do hundreds of field work, and only to find out when they graduate that pretty much anyone on the street can call themselves a social worker without having the degree or being licensed by the state. So we would urge you to move this bill forward and to support the title protection piece of the bill. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, we should move down a little bit.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacey Scala Orr, and I'm the Executive Director of NASW Oregon Chapter. And I'm here today to offer the support of NASW for SB 177-A, which expands the regulation of professional social workers and ensures greater protection of consumers in our state. Just to piggyback on much of what has already been said, we're very supportive of this legislation. I believe that, you know, as a society, we've come to trust that when persons using a certain title have completed specific training to prepare them in their work in assisting the public. For example, our residents of Oregon do not want to receive legal advice from someone identifying as a lawyer, nor receive health care from someone identifying as a nurse, for example, who do not have the appropriate degree training, who are not held accountable to professional standards and ethics, and are not regulated by the state. Accredited social work programs face stringent requirements to prepare professionals who to obtain a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree in social work. And as has been mentioned, many other states do have multi-level licensure and a Practice Act component. Currently in the state of Oregon, again, we only regulate and have title protection for the two designations, licensed clinical social worker, the LCSW, and the clinical social work associate, CSWA. Therefore, we lack at this time a bachelor's level and non-clinical level, a master's level designation. In addition, under current law, anyone, regardless of their degree training or lack thereof, can use the title social worker. We are supportive of this legislation. We believe it further regulates the profession by adding these two new designations. And it prevents individuals whose license has been revoked from continuing to practice in the state, master's level clinical social work practice. Allowing the Oregon State Board of Clinical Social Workers such authority is an important step in ensuring greater protection of consumers. In order to strengthen SB 177-A, NASW has requested an amendment that expands the title protection concept. Again, as written, the legislation only prevents a person from using title words or abbreviations to indicate that they have an that they're authorized to practice regulated social work, and it does protect the RBSW, LMSW, and the existing CSWA and LCSW designations. But again, it does not protect the title social worker, continuing to allow anyone to identify as such. We urge your support of SB 177-A and the above amendment to ensure that anyone presenting themselves to the public as a social worker has the appropriate degree and training as regulated by the state and held accountable to the professional ethics and standards that are characteristic of the social work profession. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Orr. All right, now we're open up for questions. This is a big bill, the two important amendments. So do you have questions of anyone on this panel?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I do. I'm surprised I have not received a single piece of advocacy for or against this bill in my email. Is anybody, I mean, it's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
And as we struggle with the LPC, Licensed Professional Counselors and Marriage and Family Therapists, you would have thought that this would have received similar input. And obviously you're flying under the radar, and I know many LCSWs, and none of them have come up to me on the street anywhere and said, hey, by the way, this is a great bill. So how have you communicated with your licensees?
Chair Tomei, Representative Mauro, for the record, my name is Martin Petioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Clinical Social Worker. And in the to answer the question of the representative, there are really two layers here. One is that we have actually communicated rather heavily out to our licensee base, not just via the our communication with the National Association of Social Workers. We've also sent out newsletters literally to our entire licensee base. So to the entire, we have about 3,500 people that get that newsletter either by email or by hard copy, whichever way they elect. And so that has been very, very public very early on. There was a February 2009 issue, which I'm happy to also share with you later on for the record, where we also highlighted not just the initial bill, but also already the possibility of that we're working actively with stakeholders on the Practice Act piece of for clinical social work. So that's one part of the equation. I think the second layer here really is that you are fortunate in the sense that we are coming to you relatively late in the process. If there hadn't been, quite frankly, a tremendous amount of work that happened over the last year with stakeholders, because this was not an arena where there was a lot of consensus, quite frankly, even a year ago. And the reason you don't have, you know, everybody in the world showing up in this hearing room right now is because of the work that has already happened in individual meetings. Also, it started initially out with the governor's office back in last February. There was also a work group process, I should add, on the Senate side, where Senator Morissette, the chair of the Senate committee that heard the bill, asked me to do a work group to get to a consensus on this bill, and there was also a significant amount of stakeholder discussion there. So one of the reasons you don't have a ton of people signed up in opposition is because we've really tried to give you a consensus bill, and not really... I would want to probably resist the tag of flying under the radar, because it hasn't been very under the radar on that first part of the process.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have received a number of communications on this, although it's been a while, I think. Maybe it was more when this was being handled on the Senate side, I think. But I wanted to ask you, so as this bill, if this bill is passed and now the licenses or, you know, the designation is protected, how will you go out and enforce this? Will you deal with it on a, you know, as-needed basis, or will you go out and look for cases in which, instances in which you know that people are using the label inappropriately?
Chair Representative Tomei, Representative Dembro, licensing boards in general do not go out and search for violations, and we have no plans in doing so. I mean, we have, quite frankly, quite a complaint load as it is, and we respond to complaints, quite frankly, on, what we would like to do, since as you in the bill before you, you have an effective date of most of the really new provisions, which include the new license, the new license forms on the non-clinical piece of social work, as well as the extra title protections. Those don't kick in until January 1, 2011. And so one of the logical things that we are planning on doing is, quite frankly, first a public education campaign, because the best part of compliance is, quite frankly, proactive education as opposed to waiting for complaints to come in. And so that's our first plan, is to really do that. We don't have, obviously, specific plans on how exactly that's going to happen, and we'll start working on that as soon as we know that we have a bill. But we want to be proactive first on an education front and then see what we get kind of on the complaint end of the equation. But we're not going to go out and start beating up on people.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm on a personal mission to do this advocacy group education because I've been inundated by these mass spam emails, and I want to thank you for not sending out an action alert. I do hear from my constituents on a variety of issues, but when I, and especially the ones I know, when they write to me in their own words and tell me, and I think I have heard a couple of social workers call in and say, you know, we're doing some good things, hope to see you later in the year, and, you know, that's the kind of, that's helpful to me when I hear from them in their own words. So I want to thank you for not doing that. We get enough of that anyway, and I'm going to just do it group by group as I can. So thanks.
Any further questions of this panel? I want to thank you also. I think some of you know that I was an LCSW in a previous life, and I really appreciate this. And because of complaints, and especially that we've seen in the Oregonian of some really egregious issues that have come up, it gives all social workers a bad name, and we're all sort of painted with the same brush when some people call them social workers have never had a social work class, much less people have their PhDs in social work. So I really personally appreciate all the work you've put into this, and I know you've been working on this for years because it's an issue that I've been very, very concerned about. So any further questions from this panel? Thank you again so much.
Thank
you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on this bill? Colleagues, do you want to have a work session or do you, since, okay, I'm seeing yes, it's a big bill, but you're okay with this?
Yeah, yes. Madam Chair, to move the amendment so we can get the fiscal?
We have a minimal fiscal impact on both amendments, yes. So we're good to go.
So it won't have to go to Ways and Means?
No.
So
I will forward some of my emails to you so that you can.
I've done a search.
Oh, really?
And I haven't. And it's after all the other stuff, maybe they.
I'll arrange for a counseling session for you.
So you're wanting to move this today?
Yes.
Yeah.
Terrific. Okay. So.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -7 and -8 amendments to Senate Bill 177A, dated 5th of May, 2009.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the -7 and -8 amendments to Senate Bill 177A, dated May 5th, 2009. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 177A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 177A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Keith, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Excused.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required votes, Senate Bill 177A is passed, and I will carry it on the floor. So thank you so much. I mean, it went pretty fast today, but I know that behind all of this was hours and hours and hours of work, and the work of many people who aren't in this room today. So again, I thank you very much. With that, I will close the hearing and the work session on Senate Bill 177A. And Representative Diane Rosenbaum, Senator Diane Rosenbaum, I really want her to be back in the House. Senator, you are here on Senate Bill 875. I'll open up the hearing and possible work session on 758.
Senate Bill 875 prohibits charging fees or deposits for assistance animals in rented housing.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and it's always great to be back on the House side. I am here in support of Senate Bill 875, and with me today is Bob Esterbrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I think those of you who were here in 2008 will remember that we passed a bill in the special session in February that gives the state the ability to process complaints for housing discrimination, which had formerly been done by the federal government. And in order to do that, we've had to make a series of changes to state law to make sure we're in compliance with federal law. This is one of those. So Senate Bill 875 really is a technical fix to our law to put us in compliance with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development standards for dealing with service animals in rental housing. So essentially what the bill does is prohibits fees or deposits being charged to renters who have service animals with specified disabilities. Not only will this bring Oregon into compliance with federal law, but it will also remove a huge burden on those individuals who have service animals to assist them in their daily tasks. Now, I want to point out that this bill does not prohibit other kinds of deposits that everybody would be required to pay. People with service animals will still be required to pay those, but any special deposit for the animal specifically is what would be prohibited in this case. Service animals are extremely important to the independence and quality of life of individuals with physical impairments. It's really unfair and unjust to charge extra fees for these service animals that are really part of what they need to be able to live their lives. I also want to point out that this bill did pass the Senate unanimously, so I'm hoping that you too will be able to give it your support and move the bill. Thank you for hearing it today, and by passing this bill, you can ensure peace of mind to individuals with service animals when they enter a rental agreement. It will do a lot of good for those people, and thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but Bob is probably a better position to do that. Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Estabrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. I actually don't have anything to add to the very eloquent statement that the senator just made. I am happy to answer any questions if there are any.
So I do have a question to either one of you. So as I'm looking through the bill, so it's a person who is blind and a person who is deaf. Are there any other impairments that would allow someone to bring in a service animal?
Madam Chair, yes. If you look to Section 3 of the bill, deals with the category of physical impairments. Those are the three categories that are specifically mentioned in ORS 346. Other persons with disabilities are covered by BOLI's Enforcement of Fair Housing Law under Chapter 659A, and that would cover all Oregonians with disabilities. It's in 346 where you have these specific provisions for persons who are blind, persons who are deaf, and persons with physical impairment. I would say the key here is not that this is the it is less that this is the operative statute, but to make sure that people are not confused by this existing statute into believing that a landlord could charge a fee or deposit to an individual with a service animal, because that would not be permissible under the Fair Housing Law that BOLI enforces.
I realize that. I guess what I'm asking is, it says physical impairment. So if somebody who just feels like they need a dog in the house to make them feel comfortable, and they could they say, this is my impairment, and I just want to have a dog to be company for me?
Madam Chair, the definition in 346, there is one for assistance animals there. It does not cover a companion animal, for example, but we are looking for the interim at getting some clarification for the statute, because it does specifically call out physical versus mental or emotional impairments that people might have an assistance animal for. That's an issue that we do need to have a discussion about, because the statute is not very clear on that issue. What I do want to assure the committee of, though, is that BOLI is enforcing HUD standard on service animals, which is no fee, no deposit for an individual with a service animal, because it is a reasonable accommodation for that individual.
I guess I'm still not really satisfied with that. Can you get us 346 on your computer, 346?
It's becoming indispensable.
Pardon?
They're in print behind us over there.
Faster than I can look it up.
Okay.
You probably did faster than I was showing you that.
Show me, thank you. Representative Boone.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, too. Is if a place allows pets but to anybody there but with a deposit, would they be waived that deposit then in that sense?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, yes, a service animal is not considered a pet, and therefore that individual would not be charged or should not be charged a pet deposit.
Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I don't know if you have the definition off the top of your head, but a service animal is different than a companion animal or a pet. They have specific training in accordance with the needs of the individual for whom they're providing services. Is the statutory definition in 376? I mean, this really is different than a dog because you feel better with your dog, get more comfortable with a dog in your life. That's not the same as having an animal that's trained to be a service animal, which is really a critical component to a person's functional capability.
Madam Chair and Representative Cowan, I would agree with everything that you just said, and I apologize that I did not bring that definition with me. The definition that exists in 346 specifically speaks to the sort of what you're describing as a service animal, an animal that assists a person who has, for example, difficulty bending or reaching to be able to pick up items. That sort of an animal is covered by the definition in Chapter 346. Our enforcement under 659A is somewhat broader, but I think that the definition for a service animal is a little bit, for lack of a better word, squishy, that there is not a good bright line between what is a service animal that has technical training and other, for example, companion animals. But that is a discussion that Boley is very interested in having and making sure that there is some more concrete guidance for landlords in particular to be able to identify what is, in fact, a service animal that should be protected under fair housing law.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
I think that would be an appropriate conversation to have for the benefit of landlords to be able to make the clear distinction. But this particular bill, its intent is to keep us in compliance with federal fair housing standards so that Boley can enforce them. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, that is absolutely correct. This bill addresses a specific issue that HUD has identified with the existing statute. It does not necessarily resolve or make perfect this existing statute, but it does resolve the issue that we would have with HUD and could potentially endanger our contract with them and our ability to investigate those fair housing complaints here in Oregon.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue? Mm-hmm. Colleagues, I'm not going to have a work session on this today. I think it's probably a very simple bill, but as I look through these several pages, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what kind of an animal. One of my concerns is that on the bus, often I see people on the bus, you're allowed to take a service animal, but people take on the bus any kind of animal they want because they say, oh, it's my service animal. And as a landlord myself, and I think wanting to make sure to all landlords that anybody who comes in with an animal that they want to bring into the rental, that they can say that this is a service animal. I want to make absolutely sure that we're clear on what that means. So, yes,
Representative Madam Chair, I understand the concern that you're raising. I just think it's really important for this committee to focus on the fact that this particular bill is not going to answer all those questions. That, as in testimony, that's kind of another issue that they need to explore. This one is a technical fix to align us with federal law so that Coley can do what they've been assigned to do. So I think we need to keep that in mind as we explore that.
I understand that. I just want to make it clear in my mind, and if any landlords come to me, that I can and make clear to them what this means. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're considering a bill in another committee having to do with exotic animals, and one of the amendments that has come up in that particular one is to exempt a service animal, and in some cases that is a little monkey. And so they're not just dogs, they're sometimes they're other little animals.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that might help with between the two of them, in this symbiotic relationship. Andy's interested in that service monkey.
Do they do dishes?
They do dishes. They answer the phone. They brush your teeth.
Okay, thank you, committee. Is anyone else wants to speak on this? All right, seeing not, I will close the public hearing on and the work session on Senate Bill 875. Thank you. What do we have up next?
Senate Bill 582.
Okay, Senate Bill 582. Open up a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 582.
Senate Bill 582 repeals the sunset on the requirement to notify long-term care facilities that the person seeking admission to the facility was convicted of a sex crime.
Thank you. I know Mary Gear.
Mary Gear may be on her way, but yeah, she had another committee. You have a letter from her in your...
Okay. All right, so we have Lauren Rhodes. Good to see you, Lauren.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. And on behalf of our licensed nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care facilities, we're here today in support of Senate Bill 582. Briefly, I've handed out written testimony, but I do hope to be brief. This was a bill that is a one-line bill, and I think it might be in running for the shortest bill of the session. In 2005, the legislature passed a law that requires individuals who are convicted of a sex offense to notify a long-term care facility when they're seeking admission of their status as a convicted sex offender, and giving the facility the opportunity to make sure that they can appropriately care for that individual's needs and also make sure that the rest of the resident staff and visitors to the facility are adequately protected. If the individual, however, does not disclose that information at the time of admission and is admitted into the facility, and the facility subsequently learns of that conviction and status as a sex offender, and the individual actually poses a current risk of harm to individuals in the facility, residents, staff, or visitors, then the facility can work cooperatively with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections to invoke an involuntary transfer proceeding and start to find an alternative placement for that individual. This bill has been was passed in 2005 with a four-year sunset, and I believe that was just to make sure that everything was implemented appropriately. To my knowledge, I surveyed our members prior to the session starting and asked if anybody had invoked this law, and to my knowledge, nobody has, although I have had conversations with the department that they have had calls and some proceedings with some facilities in this regard, but to my understanding, it's very infrequent and very rare that this actually occurs. We're seeking to simply remove the sunset, make this law permanent, and continue to provide adequate protections for all individuals in long-term care facilities. This passed the Senate with a vote of 30-0. We come to you today with hopefully no other opposition or concerns, and I'm happy to answer any questions and may remain brief.
Thank you, Laura. Any questions, Ms. Rhodes? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I think if we glance at Mary Gear's letter, and we've heard testimony on this issue before, probably in this committee, the original bill passed. And to me, the important part is toward the end of the first page, seniors and people with disabilities who have cognitive and communication disabilities are particularly at risk because they cannot accurately remember or tell what happened to them. So that's why I think it's extremely important to keep people who have had a history of sexual abuse out of these kinds of facilities, or at least that the facilities are aware that that has that history has occurred. Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, I think that the second part of your last line was important. It, the law isn't designed necessarily to keep people from receiving, I mean, the law isn't designed at all to keep people from receiving treatment they need, whatever their history may be, but to make facilities aware and to be able to take appropriate precautions or to have facilities designed appropriately. And so I think that's important. It's not
I do too.
Just to keep people out,
right,
to make sure that we protect everybody.
And that staff has knowledge of their past history. Any further questions or concerns? All right. I think, are we ready to pass this?
Yes.
Colleague? Great.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 582 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 582 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Denbro?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Booth?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 582 passes our committee. And I think this is one we can put on the consent calendar, don't you?
Okay. Yes.
We'll go to the consent calendar. Thank you, colleagues. Okay. What's next? Senate Bill 646. Okay. You want to read a summary on that, please?
Yeah, you want to open our actual
open
hearing.
Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 646 and the possible work session.
Senate Bill 646 requires the Department of Human Services to calculate, adopt, and submit to the Department of Administrative Services a methodology consisting of direct and indirect costs for planning and administering programs related to social, health, independent living, and protective services for persons with disabilities, calculated at 95% of the cost to the DHS if clients were served by the department rather than Type B area agencies. It requires DAS to include the budget level in the governor's budget request to the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, not here.
There he is.
Couldn't see you when you were standing. Welcome to our committee, Senator. Glad to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 646, which is an equity issue. The AAAs that provide services for the state at the county level don't receive the full equity that would be paid to state workers for providing the same services. And statutorily, it says 95% is what they should get. However, it's been as low, it's been down in the 80%. It's been raised at different times. In fact, I think it was last biennium, Lane County AAAs received some computers in as part of their compensation. This has been a problem. The department has been very good. James Taves from SPD is here. He will testify if need be, but he has been supportive and would have provided 95% during this last biennium with money that was set aside, only to have it moved out of that area and put into something else. What this bill simply says is that the agency will always put 95% in their policy option package, which they don't always do, but they have been supportive. This says that statutorily they should provide 95%, therefore they shall ask for 95% of equity. When it goes to the governor's budget, then who knows? The governor may decide not to do that. But at least we want them to follow through with the request of 95% of equity. I will end it with that and answer questions. We have Nicole Palmatier here who would also like to would you like to say a few words?
Nicole, I'm going to ask you to talk to this committee as if we don't know what type B facilities are. You're going to start from ground zero to explain what this really does.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Chair Tomei, I will do my very best to answer that as concisely as possible. As all of you are familiar with, the Area Agencies on Aging provide a variety of aging and disability services in the 17 areas that have been laid out in the state. That's been broken out into 17 different districts that the area agencies provide services. And there are two different types of area agencies. One type is a type A. Type A's are out in the smaller areas, primarily out in the east side of the state of Oregon, providing Older American Act programs such as transportation-type programs and more community-based levels that come through federal funding, as well as all type A's provide Oregon Project Independence. Up and down the I-5 corridor, there are type B area agencies, and primarily serving the major population centers of the state, including Multnomah County, Lane County. There's a 5-county one here that serves Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, Tillamook counties. Oregon Cascades West serves Lynn, Benton, Lincoln counties. They are transferred type B area agencies, and what the state has done is taken the Medicaid work for seniors and people with disabilities, which includes Medicaid eligibility, food stamps, protective services, all of those things, and transferred it to the county level so that in those areas it's provided by those particular area agencies on aging. We do the work of the state. It's exactly the same thing. You could change the sign on the door and none of the services would change. It's just that it's maintained at a local county level, which is something that happened a while ago, that it's been that way. When the area agencies took on that work for the state, we said we want to do that. We want to have those services provided at the county level because it's important to have that kind of integration into the community. We also provide a significant amount of match, local match, that comes back in from our work doing that. Last year, I believe the area agencies provided about $20 million in match, in cash as well as an in-kind back to this state. And we say we will do that for 95% of the cost because we believe that it can be a good deal from the state and we're able to leverage local dollars to do that. Since that has been in place, we've never been able to attain the 95% of funding that was put forth in statute, and there have been a lot of efforts and some really great champions to help us try to achieve that. Does that answer your question briefly?
If you have any questions, I want you to ask. If you
and certainly, Mr. Tate can probably answer
what
better
this whole concept is.
I can too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just new enough to not understand if it's in statute why it hasn't been being done.
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, that's a really good question that we would love to have answered as well. I think there are a lot of local partners with the state that suffer from the same issue that we do. I can't answer that. The department has been fantastic, seniors and people with disabilities, and putting forth and suggesting 95% in the budget as a recommendation has not always made it out the door of the Department of Human Services for consideration by the governor, for consideration by the legislative body. Sometimes it has, sometimes it hasn't, and it just hasn't been something that's been able to be afforded. I would say we recognize that in this current budget, if we haven't been able to get it before, we're probably not going to get it now. We hope to maintain the 90% that we have at the moment, which is what we were able to achieve last session. I will say the area agencies did take a cut to close out the 07-09 biennium, so our big agencies, in particular Multnomah, Cascades West, LCOG, are about 80% right now coming into the next biennium because of the cuts we've had to take, yet we're seeing tremendously increased people coming through our doors like we've never seen before. So I think that that's just been, that's a question I really can't answer for you.
Follow up. So if it's in statute, what's the answer? I don't know that we can get a bigger hammer.
Mr. Taves and maybe Patty.
May I? Well,
of course.
part of the problem is with other state. It's a pattern that the state has fallen into. For instance, we have a constitutional amendment that requires that the Quality Education Commission's recommendation be honored by the state, that you will fund education at the level recommended by the commission. That has never happened because we don't have the money. So it's a very simple reason. Lane County Regional Air Pollution Authority does the work of DEQ in Lane County. They are probably at 85-90% of equity. They don't get the same amount of money that the state does. Now, when I was on the Lane Council of Governments in the 90s, I recommended to LCOG that they give the program back. If the state doesn't provide the full equity, that they simply turn around and give it back to the state and say, you guys do it. So that is an option, and I think that's something. Now, states have given back corrections to the state. They say, we're not going to take any more felons for up to a year unless you pay us for it. Because so it's a common pattern in the, with the state of Oregon. Now, as I said earlier, I think SPD, Senior People with Disabilities, has been very cooperative and have tried to do the right thing, but budget shortfalls have interfered with that. So with that, I will turn it over to James Taves.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, in response to your question, what's in statute that was passed in 1993 was that we would develop a specific formula that would say what would the costs be to the state of Oregon if it was operating the Medicaid program, say, in Multnomah County, and that we would take exactly that formula, crossover, and then fund it at 95% for Multnomah County in that instance. What it doesn't do is absolutely require that funding. It simply says we will use that formula in our budget calculations, and we will then consider that formula in making our budget recommendations. In the last biennium, we actually, it was in the governor's budget to bring all of the AAAs in at 95% of equity. It fell off the co-chair's budget in the final days of the session, so we were trying in good faith to comply with that. What this bill does is strengthen the language from saying we'll consider that formula to say we will use that formula in putting our budget recommendations together. It still is not binding on the governor. The governor could choose not to recommend that, and the legislature could also choose not to fund it because it simply says we will use that in our budget recommendations. But it's not an absolute binding obligation.
Any further questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I think it's important for the committee to understand that reaching equity for our area agencies on aging or reaching 95% is an important piece of the comprehensive plan and the work that the stakeholder community has been doing for the last couple of years in terms of where do we need to go to most adequately manage and care for our aging population in the world of community-based long-term care needs. So this particular concept is very much part of that whole discussion that's going on. That being said, I also recognize the challenges that we're facing budgetarily, and I think that it's important to note also that while we have a statutory, and kind of to get to Representative Huffman's questions, and please correct me if I'm not accurate here, the statute reads that we must develop a formula for if we were going to provide these services at a level at which they should be provided, this is what it would cost to do it. And then if you use that formula, fund the regional providers of that service who desire to provide that service locally at a particular level. Like many other things in the budget, we don't fund at the level that we should to provide services, I think, throughout the Department of Human Services spectrum and certainly throughout the senior and people with disabilities spectrum. We know what we should be putting into long-term care issues, and we aren't doing it. And at the same rate, we're not reaching the statute. I support the bill because I think that
putting it into the policy option packages and making sure that we have it there for discussion is important as we move those budgetary conversations forward. But there are many places in the state budget that we're not meeting our obligations. This is a helpful piece to help people understand what our obligations are. Certainly, like community corrections, local counties would have the opportunity to turn these programs back to the state if they so desired. Thankfully, not only are not very many turning back the community corrections, but even fewer are moving away from their area agencies on aging because those groups are so successfully reaching out and working with our local communities. But I think it's important to understand that this bill gives a direction and a guidepost as to what we should reach, but we also have to understand that we may not reach that in many areas of the state budget and what are required. Is that fair to say?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, I'd say that's a very accurate description. We recognize what the limitations are, but this also helps make that conversation a little bit more straightforward by clarifying the language.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I think in this conversation, I think there's that even though it's not explicit, there is an assumption that those of us at the local level can always find other people's money to support what we're trying to do. And I think that's probably where you get some comfort in passing off this business to local levels.
Okay. Chair Tomei.
Yes.
I was going to respond quickly to Representative Van Orman. I would say certainly there is some of that impression. I would say Multnomah County in particular has been a very strong county in providing magnificent resources into the system. This biennium will be one of the most challenging, and they're losing a lot of dollars. It will be interesting to see what kinds of changes have to be made, particularly in that population center, as their county ability is going to be greatly limited in this next 2 years.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Anything in particular to Mr. Taves? All right. Thank you all for coming today and presenting this bill to us. Colleagues, are you ready to move this? All right. I should ask first, is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? Oh, Rip, yes, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Mullen here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Just basically to say that we have been spending some time over the last number of years, but particularly this session, concerned about a number of things happening within the department that are not really the department's doing but have to do with the funding levels. There's discussion about what will happen, what the future of mental health at the local level would be, and you heard the history of the area agencies on aging that was really, I think, provided some very, very good information to the committee. I was involved in the drafting of the legislation, and I would point out the legislation had the goal of getting to at least 95% of equity. It's talked about as 95%. When the state reabsorbs these programs, if they're sent back from the local level, it winds up costing at 100% because they have to pay the cost of the staff that's necessary to run the programs. In addition, there are additional costs that happen at the state and local level when there's this disruption that happens. But most importantly, when we have changes in direction for programs that are either coming to the local level or moving to the state level without adequate planning and funding, there's the displacement that happens on behalf of clients, which I think is a great concern. So is there a number of things that come to your attention during this session and beyond? I think some discussion in the interim, particularly some of the things that are relating to the changes that will happen with healthcare, the future of DHS as far as what would be be left in DHS if the Oregon Health Authority was created, and the discussion going on in aging and disability programs and mental health programs are worthy of some interim discussion about where we're heading. I think there are a lot of moving parts in all of this, but overall, the Human Services Coalition is always concerned that people get the kind of service that is needed and the best service provider being available to provide those services at the state and local level.
Any questions of Mr. Mullen? So, John, if I'm hearing you correctly, so you're saying that if the state were to take back any of these programs in DHS that now are provided in the throughout the state by nonprofits or by counties, that it's going to be costing DHS much more than they're currently.
That's correct. And, in fact, Clackamas County is turning its programs back at the end of this year, and it may be instructive to follow the dollars and find out what the cost of providing those services under contract were as opposed to what the costs are with the state reabsorbing the programs. I think that Representative Cowan very much talked about the reason for having those services at the local level, the coordination, the expansion of services. Nicole talked also about the way in which local governments put in additional resources, which is to everybody's benefit when that happens. But when the state reabsorbs these programs, takes them back on, there are additional cost, and I think it would be worthwhile taking a look at it.
I think what John is saying today is very important, and I hope we can sort of read between the lines here and think about this in terms of the budget we'll be looking at this session, and if we need to hear more from John, we can bring him back. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. John, one of the questions I would have is that if it goes back to the state, my concern is that there would be less people served. Is that a possibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, I believe that in the caseload programs for the Medicaid and long-term care that there would be adequate coverage that would happen with the staff. But when you look at the way in which the intent of the legislation that created this system was the idea about making sure that transportation, housing, information, and referral services, a variety of services were coordinated. With the splitting out and then taking those programs and having them under the state level, they don't have access to those county programs without having some sort of collaboration that didn't have to exist before because the work was done under one roof.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you very
Does anyone
much.
Else wish to speak on this bill? Okay. We're ready to pass this, colleagues?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 646A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 646A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wrestled with this a little bit initially as to why there was no fiscal impact, because what we're asking for is more dollars into these programs. But so I think it's just very important for us to remember that when we do pass this, we are not obligating new dollars into these programs. Editorial comment, as much as we should be. but that we're simply saying this has to be out there and presented for a conversation in a little bit different direction than we have in other budgetary development processes in future bienniums.
Thank you, Representative Cowan, for making that clear. Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, Keith, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman. Aye. Representative Dembro. Aye. Representative Maurer. Aye. Representative Van Orman. Aye. Representative Dan Orman. Aye. Representative Puffman. Aye. Representative Cowan. Aye. Vice Chair Olson. Aye. Vice Chair Kuhn. Aye. Chair Tomei. Aye.
Senate Bill 646, having received the required majority, passes. And Representative Cowan, did you want to carry this? Okay, Representative Cowan, would you carry this? Thank you.
Announcement.
Pardon?
Announcement.
Yes, just a moment. I'll close the public hearing and the work session on Senate Bill 646. Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. As you know, Wednesday we are having an informational hearing on the medical marijuana, and tomorrow evening we are having a dinner with our guests, and everybody on this committee is invited, and you can come talk to me about details about that dinner. Who we have scheduled to come speak to us is the co-owner of a company called Bedrocan BV and the United States agent for that company, and they are the company that was contracted by the Dutch Ministry on Health, Welfare, and Sport to grow medical marijuana. We have a professor, and I'll mispronounce the name, Arno Hezekamp from Leiden University, who is an expert on medicinal marijuana. We have Marco van de Velde, who is the head of the Office of Medicinal Cannabis. And we also have a late addition of Peter Tunison, who is the Education and Public Information Officer from the Dutch Embassy in Washington, D.C., will be on the in the group. And so we have an hour scheduled on Friday for them to present how...
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday, thank you. Jesus on how Christ. They've implemented their program, not about the... not about the our law, but about how they do it and how they've implemented this program. And we have a number of people that are very interested in the conversation. And so you are encouraged to attend tomorrow night if you so wish and come see me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And I would point out, I'd hope that we could, for the rest of our meetings, meet at 8:30. We're going to be meeting at 8 o'clock on Wednesday and also on Friday. So we will meet at 8 from 8 until 9 and hear Senate bills, and then we'll have the speaker. Isn't that at 9 o'clock?
It is 9 o'clock. Matt, yeah. I really would like to give them their full hour.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's, traveled
that's
an awful
our plan.
Long ways.
I know. So, any questions about Wednesday or Friday? All right. Representative Huffman.
I was just going to ask, on SB 875, are we basically just checking on the definition of an assistance animal to what is considered that at this point?
That's my interest in making sure that I understand that fully. And if you have anything else?
No, I just want clarification on what we were waiting to find out on that.
Right. Good. Okay. Any other questions or concerns or information?
Freeman. Today we received 11 pages of testimony. Are we asking folks to email us the testimony? I can't tell you how much easier that would be if they would email us this stuff.
It's on every agenda that we request that any testimony be submitted via...
It says that on the agenda.
Yeah, it says that on our agendas. Okay. In fact, at the beginning of the session, that was something that they went through was to...
Well, it's frustrating, and it's not a big deal, but when it's from our own agencies, and I go back to my office, and we have to spend time scanning this in to have it on the computer.
Right.
So they didn't send it by email at all?
Most of them don't.
I mean, some of them who, like Karen Mainzer sent this weekend, but Mary Geer then brought by written copies as well, so...
But she did send it electronically.
She did send it electronically. Yeah,
and
she did send it electronically.
I like mine in print. Yeah, I just printed off the...
Yeah, some of them we get, but the
you don't
vast
have to scan it. It's on your computer. You may have a
no,
copy
most of,
to look at.
Most
too.
Of what he got, what we got today was not
Mary
Geer's is.
Yeah, Mary's
so
is. But most of what was submitted is not. And that's, it's on the agenda. And, staff respectfully request that you submit 25 collated copies at the time of your testimony and, if possible, an electronic copy of materials provided to staff 24 hours prior to the meeting. So,
especially that 24-hour part so that you can get it to us
so that
those of us who want it printed will then be able to print it.
And, Tim, next session, we'll
I know it's a work
that.
In progress.
Yeah,
and
we'll
it's just
stress that much more. But I appreciate you being willing to go paperless. That's true.
We're trying to get there.
Yeah. Okay, anything else? All right, with that, I'll close the House Committee on Human Services.